From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why the rich are getting richer while everyone else is getting poorer. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele about how our presidents, congresses, and heads of regulatory agencies rewrote the rules in the 70s and 80s to benefit special interests at the expense of everyone else. Also today, in remembrance of rock promoter Bill Graham, we feature an interview recorded with him in 1989. Graham was killed in a helicopter crash Friday night. And book critic John Leonard reviews Martin Amis's new novel about a Nazi doctor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has arrived in Madrid for the joint U.S. and Soviet-sponsored Middle East peace talks. The Soviet president was reported to be protected by heavy security as he prepared to open the conference with President Bush. The two leaders will meet tomorrow over a working lunch, where they're expected to discuss nuclear disarmament and Western aid to the Soviet Union. President Bush will leave tonight on an overnight flight to Madrid. He told reporters today that he hopes the conference will launch a negotiation process that will lead to peace in the Middle East, but he warned that the talks are only a first step. As they prepare for the opening of the Middle East Peace Conference, Arab delegations are stressing their determination to seek the return of Israeli-occupied land. Gerald Butt filed this report for the BBC.
The delegations will be brandishing the invitation sent out by Washington and Moscow, which specifically mention UN Security Council resolutions 242 and 338 as being the basis on which Middle East peace should be built. These resolutions demand Israeli withdrawal from occupied territory. The problem is, the Israeli Prime Minister and his delegation will also be brandishing their invitations at Madrid, and their interpretation of 242 and 338 is radically different to that of the Arabs. Mr. Shamir's view is that the resolutions have been fulfilled. Sinai, captured in 1967, has been returned to Egypt and has no intention of pulling out of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Golan Heights. This is a uniquely Israeli interpretation of the UN resolutions. And unless the Americans and Soviets can bring influence to bear in the coming hours, it looks like being the first issue to bring the Israeli and Arab parties onto a collision course inside the conference.
Gerald Butt reporting for the BBC. Dr. Jack Kevorkian, the inventor of the so-called suicide machine, called today for the establishment of a Blue Ribbon Commission to develop guidelines for doctor-assisted suicide. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Kevorkian last week assisted in the suicides of two Michigan women who were seriously ill but not terminally ill. The doctor has since turned down all interview requests, but today he issued a statement through his attorney, Jeffrey Feiger.
Ethical decisions involving life and death are a patient's inalienable right and are to be resolved in privacy without intrusion by a government which would imprison compassionate and ethical physicians.
The statement goes on to call for the establishment of appropriate regulations regarding the right of people to, quote, control their own destinies. Meanwhile, prosecutors continue to investigate the circumstances surrounding last week's double suicide. They say it'll be more than a month before they determine if criminal charges should be brought against the doctor. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Stock prices were up sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 41 points to close at 3,045. This is NPR. UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar called on the Security Council today to take action against countries that have violated the arms embargo against Yugoslavia. Perez de Cuellar said he has had credible reports that the opponents in the Yugoslav civil war are being provided with weapons in violation of the Security Council embargo. Foreign ministers of the European Community warned the Yugoslav Republic of Serbia today to go along with the latest peace plan for that country or face sanctions. The warning follows growing international condemnation of the Republic and the Serbian-led Federal Army for its attacks on the Republic of Croatia. Pierre Vickery reports.
The European Community says it will give Serbia a week to agree to the compromise political settlement for resolving the Yugoslav crisis. The plan calls for human rights guarantees for ethnic minorities within existing borders. Five of Yugoslavia's six republics have already accepted the package. and the community says it will impose economic and diplomatic sanctions on November the 5th unless the Serbian government agrees to implement the proposals. The warning follows a number of unsuccessful ceasefires negotiated by the EC to try and halt the war in Croatia. Croatia has accused Serbia of prompting and leading the Federal Army in what it calls its territorial ambitions in the Republic. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has proposed to reform his republic's economy in a single year. Yeltsin warned that the process would be painful for consumers, but said the hardships would be better than an eternity of poverty. The president's plan would remove state price controls and privatize most businesses in Russia. He acknowledged that conditions would be worse for everyone for about 6 months, but predicted that the Russian economy will begin to stabilize by late in 1992. Yeltsin asked the parliament to give him additional powers to carry out the reforms. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're middle class and you think the wealthy have been prospering at your expense, you're right, according to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They just completed an investigative series for the Philadelphia Inquirer on the dismantling of the American middle class. They found that we are in the midst of the largest transfer of wealth in the nation's history. Want a shocking example? In the 1980s, the average increase in salary of people earning more than $1 million was 2,184%. Average increase for people earning $20,000 to $50,000, 44%. So the rich are getting richer, and the middle class and the poor are the losers. Why? Because in the past 20 years, Washington rigged the game to favor the privileged, the powerful, and the influential at the expense of everyone else. How? Through the tax code, the bankruptcy code, and deregulation. The tax code was rewritten in 1986, and it ended up saving wealthy individuals lots of money. Also in the 1980s, corporations exploited an old deduction, which allows businesses to not pay interest on debt. This helped finance the takeovers that reshaped the business world in the 80s.
There is absolutely no question that throughout the 80s, corporate debt was simply running out of control. And there were any number of hearings in Congress in which they examined the issue, but the special interests made sure that deduction was kept. The deduction was part of the tax code from day one, but it had not become an issue until the 1980s when the debt spiraled out of control. And as Jim indicated, the debt wasn't used to create jobs. It was really used to rearrange assets or reshuffle corporations or merge or restructure, but not to build new industries or not to invest in research and development or new products or create new jobs. And so without a doubt, the single most destructive element was the just continued unlimited deduction for corporate debt.
So in other words, you didn't have to pay tax on corporate
right.
debt. And the 80s became the decade of corporate takeovers where,
That's
you know,
right.
financed
Absolutely.
By junk bonds and everything. One company would buy another company, dismantle that company, sell it off. And
right.
And so can you explain how the pieces of that puzzle fit together in hurting the middle class? You know, it seems like a big leap to, you know, the junk bonds and the corporate takeovers to, like, our savings accounts.
You have to look at, let's just look at one company that we looked at,
yeah.
which is an example of just that process. And we looked at dozens and dozens. But one was a company called Interco, based in St. Louis, employed 50,000 people, one of the largest manufacturing companies in America. Furniture, Florsheim shoes, London Fog raincoats, a whole range of products came out of that company. It was a subject of a raid in the late 1980s, and to repulse that raid, it loaded up with a lot of debt, which then led to a payout to shareholders. Not that debt did not create more jobs or plants or whatever. Because of that debt, it was unable to generate sufficient income to pay the interest on that debt, which then led to the selling of any number of divisions, which they in turn then loaded up with debt, the closing of various plants. We talked to families in a number of places that were hurt by that. One was a little town out in Missouri called Herman, Missouri, a German town founded, strangely enough, by Philadelphians in the 19th century. The shoe plant had been there since, I believe, the middle of the 19th century in one form or another. I'm sorry, I think the early part of the 20th century, but whenever it was. It had been a fixture in the town, hardworking people, very profitable enterprise, but because the company needed to raise cash, they had to close it. And the result was people who lived there, mostly middle-class employees, who'd lived there for a long time, lost their jobs. And we saw that story repeated over and over again across America. To take care of the debt, you sell the asset, you close the plant, you scale back benefits, a direct cause and effect in terms of middle-class lifestyles.
If you're just joining us, my guests are investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They're both with the Philadelphia Inquirer, and their new series of articles, which has just been published, is called America, What Went Wrong? And it's about the dismantling of the American middle class. An interesting statistic, you know, in talking about how corporate debt was used in the 1980s, you say if your income was less than $30,000 in the 1980s, every penny that you paid in federal income tax the entire decade went just to offset the taxes lost from the deduction for interest on corporate debt. That's pretty amazing.
No, that's correct. And what people tend to forget is that when you give a tax break on one part of the system, someone else has to pick it up, or else it goes into the federal deficit, which is obviously growing and growing, and you pay the interest on that. But that corporate interest deduction, if you look at it through the 80s, that write-off was worth more to corporations than they actually paid in income taxes. In other words, they avoided more in taxes than they actually paid as a result of this single deduction.
And that was a complete turnaround from, let's say, the 1950s, even really the 1960s, and then the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. And that's what's significant about it. It's not something that's always been that completely flip-flopped in the 1980s.
This is an important point because we're talking about laws and regulations, and what has happened in the 80s really wasn't new. I mean, it's happened before in this country. You saw it back at the turn of the century, and you saw it again in the 1920s. You saw it at the turn of the century with the creation of the fortunes at that time and the corporate restructurings that went on then and then again in the 20s. But what is different this time is that there's no response from Congress. There's no response from Washington. You go back at the turn of the century, you see the child labor laws, you see the antitrust laws, you see an incredible outpouring of legislation to try to correct the imbalance that has built up. And it culminates really with the passage of the federal income tax, the progressive income tax. You go into the 1920s, there's again a lot of corporate restructuring. The tax code is revised to favor those at the top, and you have the same situation emerge. Then you go into the 30s, and Congress responds again with a whole laundry list of social reforms and programs culminating with Social Security. Now you're into the 1980s and the 1990s, and there is dead silence out of Congress. The responses that came earlier throughout this century are not there.
If you're just joining us, my guests are James Bartlett and Donald Steele, and they're investigative reporters who've worked as a team for many years. They've just concluded a new series of articles for the Philadelphia Inquirer called America, What Went Wrong? And it's about the dismantling of the American middle class. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele are my guests. Their new series for the Philadelphia Inquirer is called America, What Went Wrong? And we've been talking about how the tax codes changed and how that helped the wealthy, how it helped corporations, how it hurt the middle class and the working class. Now, the bankruptcy code was also rewritten in a way that you say also helped to restructure the corporate world in a way that hurt working people. What went wrong?
Well, I think it's like so many things. Certain intentions were right. You wanted to reform the bankruptcy laws. You wanted to create your own jurisdiction to handle this. And even one of the original ideas supposedly was to protect jobs. You don't put a company out of business. You let it stay in business so the jobs are kept and so forth. But the problem is because bankruptcy reorganization has become so appealing, companies at the drop of the hat anymore, once they've loaded up with debt and so forth, very often go into bankruptcy and then go through a dismantling process. They're not usually completely shut down. But the process of reorganizing in bankruptcy has become a whole new industry now.
You say that in the 1980s there was the largest increase in corporate bankruptcies since the Depression.
You can look at the financial statements of just literally hundreds of companies, and you look down the list of numbers, and what you see is the company is actually making a profit until they come to the payment of interest on their debt, and the entire profit disappears, and they're actually in the hole because they are not generating enough money to pay the interest on their debt. These are companies that were profitable prior to taking on the debt, would have been profitable, would have stayed in business, would have paid taxes. And this is why the corporate tax collections have also fallen, because that interest basically wipes out all their tax bills.
One of the articles that you wrote in this series, I think, is very disturbing, and it's about how fragile our pension funds are. I don't know. I think when you have a pension, you think, well, it's going to be there when you retire. But you're cautioning us that some pension funds, in fact, won't be there when we retire.
This, as Jim indicated, this is another case of good intentions gone awry. When Congress created the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the idea was to guarantee people's pensions. And this came after Studebaker Corporation folded, and you had thousands of people who had worked there all their lives and wound up with no pension. And so what Congress did was, well, we'll create this guarantee fund, very much like the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation for banks. Companies will pay a dollar a worker, and that'll guarantee everybody's pension. And on the surface, it seemed like a good idea. But what has happened is that, once again, it's been twisted. So the companies that are mismanaged simply go into bankruptcy or abandon their pension plans, whereas the well-managed companies that remain must pick up the slack for those failed businesses. And as those failed businesses increase, the well-run companies are called upon more and more to create more and more contribute more and more money to this purpose. So they are naturally looking at this and say, we don't need this. They're changing their pension plans and bailing out of the system. So as a result, the percentage of the workforce with a guaranteed pension has been declining steadily.
Now, you also found that debt-financed corporate takeovers ended up looting a lot of pension plans.
Absolutely, because this became a way to use that cash for additional raids on other companies. And again, the federal government basically passed on that process of the removal because that was a rule that they looked the other way on in the 1980s, because all the actuarial studies said that you could do this and you could achieve that result. But one of the things that nobody could ever answer is that the basis of it was supposedly these funds were overfunded. One of the reasons they were overfunded was because of some economic activity in the 80s where stock prices went up, where asset values went up. Now, in retrospect, probably on an inflated basis, a lot of those assets were taken out at the time. And now, when nothing is going to perform in exactly the way it had been in the 80s, the removal of those funds from those plans is not going to look so nice.
This was another aspect of that. It was kind of a heads-I-win-tails-you-lose situation in which the government says you can take the money out of the pension fund, and if the pension fund collapses, the government will pay the pensions. It didn't say, on the other hand, that the company would be responsible for those pensions if it took the money out. So the company kind of had it both ways. It could take the money out, and if the company collapsed, just walk away from it all.
Sounds a lot like the savings and loan situation.
It is a carbon copy of the savings and loan. And last Friday, I believe, there was testimony in Congress from the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation that the underfunded pensions went up another $10 billion in the last year. They now stand at $40 billion, and that's growing.
So in various ways, we, the individual citizens of America, are paying for the savings and loan crisis. We're paying for the looting of pension funds.
You're paying for everything.
So the fate of the middle class now. We're facing more unemployment, harder to get health insurance, more expensive health insurance, loss of various benefits from guaranteed pensions to dental plans and health insurance plans. What else? What are some of the other traumas that the middle class is facing now?
I'd like to talk about one, which isn't, you can't put an economic dollar on it, but it has to do with something we came across time and time again, company after company, across industries, from manufacturing to retail to you name it, and it's loyalty. I mean, so many people worked for companies. They felt loyal to these companies. They spent their entire working life in these companies. Maybe they were 49, 50, 55, 56, and it had been a good company to work for, and they loved their jobs, they were hardworking, and then their life was completely turned upside down. I mean, it's kind of a violation in a way of the American work ethic for a lot of those people. I mean, it's a terrible loss, I think, of faith in the entire system that anyone who's gone through that process has suffered. You can't put a dollar sign on it, but that was a theme that we kept running. We ran into that almost from day one, and we kept running into it time and time again. The quotes sounded the same. You talk to a timber man in the Sierras of California, and his quotes would sound very similar to a glass worker in West Virginia or to a shoemaker in Missouri or somebody else down in Texas.
I think that was one of the most startling revelations out of this whole project, because he would come back from one part of the country and I would come back with another, and our quotes would almost be identical. And they were coming from people who obviously totally different work in totally different working conditions, totally different industries, but their attitudes toward the companies they worked for were identical.
So this kind of thing could really undermine, in the future, a sense of commitment to the place that you work.
I don't think there's any question about undermining loyalty to a company. There's absolutely no question about it. You heard that over and over and over again from people who would say, I will never do that again.
And I'll never trust the people I work for again.
That's exactly right.
And it has a downward movement, obviously within their families and within their communities. When people see an institution that has been such a vital part, completely in effect, turn on the people for whatever reason, it sort of poisons the well.
So just to highlight some of the areas that you've covered here, deregulation, including deregulation of the savings and loan crisis, changing tax code, inability for corporations to pay less on their taxes, all of this basically making life easier for wealthy individuals and wealthy corporations and making life harder for the working and middle class. What do you point to? Was it the presidents, the Congress?
There's people on both sides of the aisle, which is the phrase they use in Washington, really can share, take a lot of credit for what has happened here or share some of the blame, depending on how you look at it. And I think that's a point that Don and I would really like to emphasize, that we are the most non-political people you will ever find.
You two?
The two of us. It's not a matter of Republicans or Democrats or anything like that. You can see that while in the 80s you had a Republican in the White House, in fact, many of these measures were started prior to that. The whole deregulation concept predated Reagan's arrival in the White House, though he obviously embraced this tremendously. Trucking and airline deregulation were under Jimmy Carter, and the people that pushed that in the Senate were basically Democratic. The principal instrument that led to a lot of the savings and loan debacle was the Rhode Island Democratic congressman, and who raised the depository insurance limit up to 100,000. I mean, that insured a lot of that chaos. So there's a lot of blame really on both parties. So it's not a simple thing like that. And I think in part that may be what is complicating the process of trying to come to grips with this, because both have had a share in what's happened.
One of the places where you put the blame is at the foot of the lobbyists and the Congress who is influenced by the lobbyists. You point out Michael Milken basically had his own lobby to make sure that corporate debt remained tax exempt.
Absolutely, because the engine that drove the whole junk bond movement was corporate debt. That was the deduction for interest paid on corporate debt. And what you see in Washington over and over again is that lobbies arise to deal with specific situations, and then they vanish when they feel that the house is secure.
I think the most frightening words in your whole series were these: the worst is yet to come.
I think those words go to the heart of what we've been saying, is that you see nothing happening in Washington. You see no recognition that there is something really seriously wrong that requires not just a little tinkering or a little fine-tuning, but some massive changes in the way things are being done.
I mean, for example, nobody would like to see everybody get a better tax break than we would, but the response now is we've got to cut the taxes of the middle class. That's a great issue just to toss out to make people pay attention and so on. But it's a lot broader than just that. I mean, this is like now it's swung back, we'll pander to the middle class here. By the tax policymakers in Washington, they're all churning out their programs to middle class tax relief. when in fact many of the same people are the ones that got the country into this particular situation. It's a much broader range of tax issues than just something like that. But that sounds real good as a nice little one-liner.
It's an extraordinarily simplistic response to what is really a very complicated situation. You had, when you go back to the 86 Tax Act, both Republicans and Democrats sold that tax reform act as helping the middle class. It did not. It was probably the single most destructive tax act since the 1924 Act as far as middle class America was concerned.
The elections are coming up. Is election time a depressing time for you because all these major issues are never discussed or certainly not discussed in their full, complicated, difficult...
They're sometimes not discussed at the top, but I'll tell you what fascinated us about this entire project, and at the risk of repeating something we said earlier, what we found just astonishing when we were in, again, the foothills of the Sierras or places in Texas or the upper Middle West or little towns in Michigan, a lot of these people have a very good fix on some of the issues that are facing the country. And a lot of those people talk about these issues all the time, strangely enough, contrary to what many of our perceptions are about people not caring about this and that. I think a lot of the country is very upset and very worried and very concerned about the direction it's moving. Whether or not that will bubble up to debates at the top or not, I don't know. And this may get back to some bankruptcy of political theory and thought and provocative ideas. But people down below, I think, have a good feel for what some of those issues are and they're concerned about.
That's absolutely right. It was just mind-boggling, the recognition of ordinary working people have of the problems that are out there. They could sit down and talk about it far better than anything you would hear out of Washington, or quite frankly, anything you hear out of the candidates.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in Philadelphia are talking about this series of articles, and a lot of people are really outraged by what you've revealed, by the inequities that you've revealed. I'm wondering what kind of impact you wanted this series to have. I don't know if you think of it in those terms when you're actually doing the research.
No, we don't. I think that's another reason we've worked together so long. We operate from the position that we lay the information out there for people. And if they respond to it, fine. And if they don't, okay. But we're not missionaries, and that's not the purpose of this kind of reporting. It's simply to collect information that people can't get from any other source and to give it to them and then let them react to it. And it does work. It worked in our last series, The Great Tax Giveaway, because that resulted in such an outpouring of mail to Congress that the Tax Writing Committee shut down the process of transition rules in which they gave tax breaks to certain individuals, targeted tax breaks to specific individuals. And the response was incredible, and so it works.
Well, thank you both very much.
Well, thank you.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele have just completed a series of investigative articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the series is called America, What Went Wrong? It's about the dismantling of the American middle class. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bill Graham first became famous in the 60s as the rock promoter of the counterculture. He became perhaps the world's best-known producer of rock concerts and rock benefits like Live Aid and the Amnesty International rock tours. Graham died Friday night in a helicopter crash. We remember him today with a 1989 interview. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from Martin Amis. It's called Time's Arrow, and it's about a Nazi doctor who relives the atrocities he committed during the Holocaust. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the Middle East, two Israelis were killed in ambush in the occupied West Bank as they traveled by bus to a pro-government rally in Tel Aviv. Hillary Brown reports from Jerusalem.
The bus was moving in a convoy of three vehicles carrying settlers from the Israeli settlement of Shiloh to the demonstration in Tel Aviv. It was attacked near the West Bank town of Nablus. One of the settlers, a woman, was killed instantly, along with the driver of the bus. Israeli television tonight reported that at least five people were wounded, including children. The Israeli army has closed off the area and is searching for the gunman. News of the attack was announced by a loudspeaker to the crowd of about 50,000 pro-government demonstrators in Tel Aviv who observed 2 minutes of silence to honor the dead. Some called for revenge. The attack seems to be an attempt to torpedo the Madrid peace talks. Government officials said the prime minister will respond tomorrow before his departure for those talks. For National Public Radio, this is Hillary Brown in Jerusalem.
In Turkey, a group opposed to the upcoming Middle Eastern peace conference has claimed responsibility for two bombings. In one explosion, a U.S. serviceman was killed, and in the other, an Egyptian diplomat was seriously injured. It was the fourth attack on a U.S. citizen in the last year. Three Americans have been killed in those attacks. In Washington, President Bush said today that he's not relaxed about the U.S. economy, but he does not plan to submit to what he called congressional panic that might make things worse. The president says that he will fight tooth and nail to help stimulate the economy. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Mr. Bush says if only the Democrats in Congress would approve of his domestic programs, including a transportation bill and enterprise zones, the economy wouldn't be so bad off. The president, speaking in a teleconference with the American Gas Association convention in California, said while there is a lot to be done,
I am not going to jump in and take steps out of some congressional panic that might make the situation worse or might burden future generations of America more.
A number of Democratic lawmakers have proposed tax cut plans in recent days to help stimulate the economy. The president has called for a capital gains tax cut and expanding IRAs, but beyond that, administration officials disagree over what steps should be taken to get the economy out of its slump. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says that the U.S. economy has grown sluggish after showing a bit of growth in the spring and summer. He spoke today in Rhode Island. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 41 points in moderate trading to close at 3,000. This is NPR News. In Moscow, the various Soviet republics have agreed to share the burden of paying back an estimated $65 billion in foreign debt. This agreement came today after 2 days of talks with deputy finance ministers from the group of seven major industrialized nations. Only 10 minutes before the agreement of understanding was signed, a sentence was added saying that the former Baltic republics also bear some responsibility for the Soviet debt. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has submitted a program of radical economic reform to the Russian parliament, and he called on the people to support it. However, the Russian leader warned that in the short term, living standards will be lowered. Tim Hewell of the BBC reports from Moscow.
For years, Mikhail Gorbachev and his ministers have talked of a gradual phased transfer to a market economy. Mr. Yeltsin made clear he had no sympathy with that approach. Prices, he said, would be freed all at once later this year.
Without the lifting of price controls, all talk of a market is merely empty chatter. Everyone's known that for several years, but no one's had the courage to take such a difficult decision.
Mr. Yeltsin also announced tough measures to limit the money supply. But even so, there's certain to be major inflation. The Russian leader said there'd be a new program of social security, including the provision of soup kitchens for the worst off. But he admitted that that wouldn't be enough to prevent widespread hardship this winter.
Tim Huell of the BBC reporting from Moscow. According to officials in Hungary, Yugoslav airplanes attacked a border village last night. A military spokesman says that a cluster bomb hit a village about 120 miles south of Budapest, causing major damage but no injuries. A Serbian official called this reported attack an accident. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We've lost many great rock performers to car accidents and plane crashes on the way to and from concerts. Friday night, we lost the world's most important rock impresario. Bill Graham died in a helicopter crash on the way home from a concert by Huey Lewis, which he had promoted. Graham was 60 years old. We remember him now with a 1989 interview I recorded with him in San Francisco. It was there that he first made his mark as the rock promoter of the psychedelic scene. He came up with the idea of turning old theaters into rock venues. He had the Fillmore in San Francisco and the Fillmore East in New York. He eventually branched out into every aspect of rock promotion and was a producer of several groundbreaking international benefits like Live Aid and the Amnesty International concert tours. In the 60s, when Bill Graham got into the rock business, lots of the people who went to his concerts thought of business as a dirty word.
Music was chosen by the mass to be free because to a great extent it was free in the park on the weekends, and it was very difficult to tell the public also that many of the shows that were staged on the weekends, we provided the sound and the lights from the profits that we earned from the Fillmore. But the word business, or any connotation of business or the law, the cops, the pigs, the fuzz, was a negative aspect of our society.
Well, how did you deal with that as a businessman? Did you feel like you had to defend yourself and defend making a profit?
It was by far the most difficult time of my life, the most joyous because it was all new and it was fresh, and there were no blueprints in how to run these kinds of concerts and how to deal with the public. The difficulty was in having the patrons look at me as perhaps the enemy, or if it wasn't for people like you, music would be free, and trying to explain to them that in order for music to be free, all the other elements that go into the concert must be free. Trucking must be free, electricity, telephones, transportation, getting the artists to the facility, and all the people that work here would have to have other means of income. But we all need to deal with the reality of life. Dealing with that reality at that time with the power to the people syndrome was at times very debilitating, and being the point man was very unpleasant.
Did you get into philosophical debates with audiences and with rock musicians about
every
how much
day.
Profit was the appropriate amount of profit
every
to take?
Day? There wasn't a day that went by. Why is the ticket price that high? Why isn't it free, or the whole spare change, and why can't I get in free when I don't have the funds? But I would always challenge anybody's forceful attempt to enter a facility because they felt it was their right that this should be free. Because invariably I'd say, what does your father do? And if he was a plumber or a baker, I said, well, I'd like to get my plumbing fixed for free. I'd like some bread for free, and tell me your father's address. And that hit a stone wall. But it took years to get over the past that.
Was there a difference between the way you were running your operation and the way people from the counterculture who were producing concerts were running it?
Well, there were other people who were very sincere in their approach also. One of the things that I tried to do is to bring in music that they didn't ask for, but music that I know was important and became very important to me, if it was Latin or jazz or R&B, and knowing that the airplane or the dead or Quicksilver would sell all the tickets, I wouldn't have to worry about the drawer. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go to Chuck Berry and all the Staples singers, as I said. And yet these artists had become, the film became relatively famous rather quickly. But it became famous as a psychedelic place, and that's where you, my God, if certain people touch you, you're never going to be the same. And we had the strobe lights there and the light shows. So it wasn't that easy to convince these artists. And eventually I had to go to Wentzville, Missouri, to talk to Chuck directly. I went to Macon, Georgia, to talk to Otis Redding, to convince him to come out. And when they did come out, the audience was their acceptance. To this day, my fondest memories of this business are watching a predominantly white audience look at Chuck Berry or look at the Staples Singers and look at Albert King or B.B. King or Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. Or we would bring in, we did a show once with The Birds and two one-act plays by Leroy Jones. Another time we did a show with the Russian poet Andrei Voznesensky and Jefferson Airplane, and watching the Russian ladies listen to the poetry and then watching them listening to rock and rolls. It was all new for me and it was all new for them. It was the most exciting time of my life.
As the businessman in the rock world, you were dealing with a lot of groups who were getting high a lot and who were into the counterculture. I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of groups who wanted to turn you on and see what happened?
Yeah.
That actually happened once, didn't it?
It's happened more than once, but it happened one time in particular where it was the only time that I ever knowingly lost it to some extent, just went with it. Yeah.
This is the Grateful Dead story?
Yeah.
7-Up, was it?
Yeah.
Well, tell us what happened.
They played the Fillmore quite often, and it was always, come on, Bill, let's get happy together. And I had a very strong rule about my work life, that during working hours, I was straight, and I expected everybody that worked at the film to be the same. And I pushed that very strongly, because we need to be clean and clear to deal with the public and the artists. And I have no right to tell them what they need to do, as long as they were civil and relatively humane. And in those days, I drank a lot of 7-Up. Just it was my liquid of that era. And it had gotten to a point where my wife, when I went to work at Dead shows when they played the Fillmore, would pack my lunch and put it in a bag and put a wax seal on it and take my thermos and just make sure that everything that I had wasn't tampered with, which is true. And I'd break the seal and have my lunch and touch nothing else there. Except some 7-Ups, but nothing else. Wouldn't eat anything there. And this particular evening when they were playing at the place, I walked into their dressing room, and it was just a habit. I would always walk in, go to one of the tubs that we had that was full of 7-Up and Coca-Cola and whatnot, and have a drink. And they knew this, so this particular night, unbeknownst to me, someone, who I eventually came to find out who that was, someone had taken a hypodermic needle and stuck it through the cans of 7-Up in this particular bucket, and nobody else touched them. They said, that's the Graham lair. That's where he's going to dip in. And sure enough, I picked up a can of 7-Up, and about a half hour later, I was on my way to Mars. And I felt very good and felt very much at ease and felt very elated and very riding on a carpet. And Mickey Hart in the band asked if
this
I
is
wanted
the drummer from the
yeah,
Grateful Dead.
If I wanted to come on stage with the guys, and I said no. I just introduced the band. He said, "Well, we'll only play if you come on stage, and here's a drumstick, and why don't you lead the band, and tell us what songs you want to hear, and whatever that is, we'll just play that, and we'll keep going all night long." Well, that night I conducted this the band from the stage the whole night, and just hit the cymbals, and hit the barbells, and played the cowbell, and it was by far the most uninhibited night of my life.
Were you embarrassed or liberated
Not
the day
at all.
After?
The day after, I just wondered if I had made a total ass of myself. But I didn't think I did, and I didn't remember that I did, and never went beyond the context of doing what they invited me to do. I didn't go beyond that. I didn't try to sing. I didn't try to shout. And and I didn't try to dance. I just I know their songs quite well, and just picked some songs, and they played them. It was a joyous event. It really was.
Did it change your life in any way?
No.
No.
No. But I had already become a fan of that scene. Not just the music, but the fact that these people, that the group never used to this day doesn't use props. They don't wear tight pants. There are no hydraulic lifts. there's no tumbling drum set. And the people come into a space, they're all doves, and they basically come to enjoy themselves and partake in a sort of union. And I'm very much in favor of that.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with rock impresario Bill Graham, who died Friday night. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We return to a 1989 interview with the late Bill Graham.
Now, you closed the Fillmore, East and West, in 1971.
Correct.
What were your reasons?
Sometimes the thing that breaks your back is a slight thing, but there were things leading up to it. I had been having considerable problems having groups continue to play there. Rock and roll became very, very popular in 70, 71, 72. And many of the groups wanted to play a Madison Square Garden or the Cow Palace because they were becoming more successful. And at that time, I was having many problems with managers and agents fighting off this price avalanche that bands said, but we can earn $100,000 up there. I said, well, play there, but also play here. But in early 71, one of the few heroes that I had was a great international impresario of show business named Saul Hurok. And he had called me, and I went to see him, that he had a month's cancellation in April of 71 at the Metropolitan Opera House, that the Stuttgart Ballet had to cancel, and would I be interested in coming in and co-producing a series of events with him there? And I thought it was a great opportunity to even further legitimize rock and roll. And I thought some of the quality bands like the Birds and the Band and the Mothers of Invention, many of them could go into the Metropolitan Opera House. And I began lining them up, but a particular phone call that I received from a manager of a band who returned my phone call when I said, this is a great opportunity for your group to go into the Metropolitan Opera House. It's a very expensive building, but isn't it great to be able to do that? And he returned my call right after a late show at the Fillmore, and I was sitting in the office around 3. And when he said, what's the money? I said, well, for the week, for 6 shows, you can make $50,000, which was still a lot of money. But in rock and roll terms, it had already become not so high when you realize what you can earn somewhere else. And his exact words to me were, you expect my boys to work for a lousy 50 grand a week? That did it.
So you closed up?
Yeah.
The rock world has become much more corporation-dominated than it's ever been before. You have something of a rock empire yourself, but it's not like the really large corporations, the multinationals, who are sponsoring some of the rock tours. Do you feel that some of your business is being taken away by the corporate sponsors who are underwriting some of the really large rock tours?
Well, not really. For example, here locally, we built an amphitheater and spent most of my savings to build this facility. But the one thing that an opportunity I had was to be we were offered substantial millions of dollars to allow corporate signage inside the facility. And I have always felt very strongly that when somebody buys a ticket and sits down to look at the stage, that there is nothing, there are no cars being thrown at you, or cigarettes being thrown at you, or soft drinks, that you came to see that artist. To the best of my ability, I've tried very hard not to do that. And I'm rock and roll is part of big business. And I have become part of that, and I can't be that hypocritical. I don't nearly enjoy a show in a stadium as much as I enjoy in a show in a theater. And if my saying no would mean that that artist would play in a theater, I would do so. But if an artist can earn in one stadium show what it would take him a week to earn in a theater, he invariably makes a decision to play in the stadium, because in the end, it means less time on the road earning a living and more time to partake with the pleasures of having made it. I would just as soon work 5 nights in a theater and earn the same amount of money as I would in 1 night in a stadium.
For the past few years, you've been doing a lot of really big benefits, Live Aid, the Amnesty International tours, a big crack benefit concert in New York, and you've got you're co-producing a series of concerts to concerts against AIDS coming up in San Francisco. How did you get into doing that?
It's not really getting into anything. That came from the meme troupe days of just being involved with the community. I'm always leery about how to state this, because people think, well, he must be covering up something. That is it public relations? Is it an image? It's very simple. That we have a certain talent, and I have a certain talent in public assemblage and producing shows. And I live in this community, and I'm concerned about this planet. I don't perform. Any time anyone approaches us regarding a project that I think is valid, if it's to raise money to save the library, send kids to camp, whatever it might be, if it's valid, I then try to explain to you what our services are. You, who come to us with the project, need to have the bands commit. If the bands commit, we will drive the bus. We will sell the tickets. We will get the sound and lights. And we cover our expenses. We never want to make a profit. But that is our strength, so that you can go to an artist and say, we want to save this recreational pool, and will you play? But if they say to you, well, how will you produce the show? You don't know how to do that. We do. So you can say, well, BGP will do that. That is our service, and that's the best way that we can put back, just the way that's the way the Grateful Dead can put back, or the Bruce Springsteen can, or Sting. The way they can put back is by being the power that draws the people there to buy the ticket.
Rock impresario Bill Graham, as recorded in 1989 in San Francisco. Graham died Friday night in a helicopter crash. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, are you going to be preparing us for the peace conference?
Absolutely, Terry. We have a piece coming in from Israel on events there today and over the weekend. We talked to an expert on the Palestinians to see what kinds of things he thinks they may be willing to accept, and we'll take a good look at what the U.S. expects to happen in this conference. Also, a piece on women and the Senate. The Clarence Thomas hearings called attention to the fact that there are very few women in the Senate, and so we asked the question, will it stay that way? And a report on kids carrying guns to school.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. British novelist Martin Amis took on greed and the age of Thatcherism in his novel Money. His other titles include Other People, Success, London Fields, and The Rachel Papers. His new novel is Time's Arrow. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
I'm still puzzling over the last Martin Amis novel, London Fields. Was it as great as it wanted to be? It was certainly long enough, and sufficiently postmodern and narcissistic on the subjects of language and the disintegration of personality, and told us what we needed to know about an imperial city in decline, and was the best book ever written about the game of darts. But with greatness, there is usually generosity, and Martin Amis is no more generous than his father, Kingsley. Now we have a very short Martin Amis novel, and it's brilliant. And because it's about the Holocaust, generosity is irrelevant. You will be hearing a lot about Time's Arrow in weeks to come. Galleys have been around for months, and many people are already upset, because you're not supposed to be brilliant and tricky and stylish about the Holocaust. You're supposed to be numb, or stammer, or scream. Martin Amis, instead, writes backwards. That is, he imagines a man, an accident victim in a contemporary American hospital, who not only remembers his life against his will, back to the trauma of his war years in Germany, but who experiences every aspect of that life, the food he ate, the women he loved, the deeds he did, even his conversations, in reverse, like a wrong-way film, or Nietzsche's dreadful doctrine of eternal recurrence. Thus, to pick an example that's charming instead of horrifying, there are the yellow cabs of New York. They're always there when you need one, we are told, even in the rain or when the theaters are closing. They pay you up front, no questions asked. They always know where you're going. They're great. No wonder we stand there for hours on end, waving goodbye, or saluting this fine service. The streets are full of people with their arms raised, drenched and weary, thanking the yellow cabs. Now imagine this same technique applied to everything else. In church, we take money out of the collection plate. On the street, garbage men strew trash. At the dinner table, we vomit up our food. In hospitals, doctors dismember their patients. At Auschwitz, Jews are saved from ovens by helpful Nazis who reattach their beards and send them home in trains. It turns out that our man, the accident victim, was a doctor at Auschwitz who financed his escape from the occupation and his several changes of identity with the gold he stole from the teeth of the Jews. Trapped in a backwards dream of himself, he must return through denial to that moment when he ceased to be human. Like psychoanalysis, a devolution. Like history, written as if it had to be, as if what happened were inevitable. Like gravity, the fall into sin. The test of a stylistic trick is what it does to us inside, what it makes us feel in the intimacy of our emotions, our reptilian fearfulness. Because Time's Arrow is written backwards, we have to slow down to read it, and the horror catches up. It's not just that the Holocaust was a moral inversion. It's that history is arbitrary, a falsification that assumes a logic that didn't exist, a fictitious causation from a poisoned premise. We chose this evil. It didn't just happen to us. After Time's Arrow, we see, feel, and think differently. That's an amazing thing for a novel to do.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Time's Arrow by Martin Amis. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, and Thad Kirk. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two fascinating artists from abroad. Pakistani novelist Vapsi Sidwa talks with us about working for women's rights in her country. And we meet Dutch jazz composer and musician Willem Bruecker. His music has the adventurousness of an avant-gardist and the sense of humor of a vaudevillian. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.